Today, Switzerland is known as a neutral, mountainous country in the heart of Europe. But was it always so? In the Middle Ages, it was a strategic hub, a place where armies, caravans, and political interests intersected. Here, peasants rose up against knights, and communities built a new order. Societies founded on unity, self-government, and the strength of ordinary people. The formation of Switzerland is a story of struggle, survival, and an unexpected rise. How did this mountain country turn into a symbol of neutrality, and at the same time give Europe the fiercest infantrymen of its age? In the late Middle Ages, the territories of present-day Switzerland were part of the Holy Roman Empire. Almost every town and valley lived by its own rules, with its own history, laws, and interests. Yet, it was among the Alpine communities that a shared idea began to take shape: to unite their forces in order to defend their freedom. The Hohenstaufen dynasty, which ruled the Holy Roman Empire in the 12th to 13th centuries, laid the foundations for the future Swiss Confederation. The Hohenstaufens adhered to the policy of so-called Reichsfreiheit, imperial liberty. It meant that certain lands of communities were subject directly to the emperor, bypassing local dukes or princes. Such a status, Reichsfrei, was of great importance. It guaranteed autonomy. Communities could govern their own affairs, collect taxes, elect judges, and maintain their own guard. Today, bringing an idea to life is faster than ever. Now, powerful tools are making this process accessible to absolutely everyone. One such revolutionary tool is Lovable. It's a service that lets you create websites and apps just by chatting with an AI. You don't need to be a programmer or designer. Simply describe what you want, and Lovable builds it for you in minutes. Imagine creating a landing page, a portfolio, or even an online store. Previously, this required deep technical knowledge or a significant financial investment. With Lovable, you can start building it yourself, right now. What makes it so powerful? Full-stack apps. Lovable builds both the visual front-end and the back-end logic, so you get a fully working tool, not just a design. Instant edits. Change anything, from colors to features, with a simple text command or by visual editor. Quick launch. When your project is ready, just hit the publish button and get a link to share with the entire world. Lovable empowers countless people who can't code to finally start creating powerful digital products. This is the true democratization of technology, where anyone with a good idea can bring it to life. Ready to create something online? This is your chance, and it's free to try. Go to lovable.dev to start creating today, and with our promo code HISTORYYT20, you'll get a 20% discount on the service's advanced features. When imperial authority was strong, the system worked. But during the time of the interregnum, a period of political instability when the empire lacked strong centralized rule, the situation worsened. At that time, conflicts in the region sharply intensified. Princes, counts, and great monasteries began to actively expand their possessions, often by force. A particular threat to the mountain communities came from the House of Habsburg. It had far-reaching plans for the central Alpine lands. The Habsburgs sought to subjugate the valleys of Uri, Schwitz, and Unterwalden, which had previously enjoyed Reichsfrei status. This was one of the reasons why, in 1291, three communities concluded the Federal Charter, which marked the beginning of the old Swiss Confederacy. Over time, the story of the beginnings of Swiss statehood became enshrined in legend. The most famous of these are the tales of William Tell and the Oath on the Rutli Meadow. These stories became symbols of national identity, passed down from generation to generation, and preserved for centuries. They were first mentioned in the White Book of Saarland. According to legend, three representatives of the free communities, Werner Stauffacher of Schwitz, Walter Fürst of Uri, and Arnold von Melchtal of Unterwalden, met secretly in the forest clearing of Rutli. They swore an oath of loyalty to one another. They pledged that each community would support the others in case of threat and would not submit to an external ruler without the consent of their citizens. The representatives of the communities vowed to defend freedom together. The tale was deeply etched into the memory of generations. And, although there is no historical evidence of this meeting, Switzerland has officially recognized August 1st, Rutli Day, as a national holiday. Another legend about William Tell celebrates the hero the people so greatly needed. When it comes to the beginnings of Swiss independence, his name is mentioned most often. Tell is not merely a character of folklore, but a symbol of the struggle for freedom, equality, and dignity. According to the legend, at the beginning of the 14th century in the canton of Uri, the Habsburg governor Albrecht Gessler imposed harsh rule. He ordered a hat to be placed on a pole in Altdorf as a symbol of imperial authority. Every passerby was required to bow to it. Tell refused to pay respect to this sign of submission. As punishment for disobeying the order, Gessler forced Tell to shoot an apple with a crossbow from atop his son's head. The hero of the legend placed a bolt in his crossbow and prepared another. The arrow he fired split the apple in half. Gessler congratulated Tell on his remarkable shot and asked why he had prepared a second arrow. Tell replied that it was meant for the governor himself if the first one had struck the boy. Gessler grew angry and ordered Tell to be thrown into prison, but he escaped during a storm on Lake Lucerne. Seeking revenge, Tell ambushed the governor in a mountain pass and shot him dead. These legends emphasize the importance of the canton's unity and their readiness to resist external threats. One of the Swiss enemies were the Habsburgs. They increasingly sought to establish control over the Gotthard Pass, the shortest route between Germany and Italy. Yet these ambitions clashed with the interests of the cantons of the old Swiss Confederacy, which enjoyed imperial privileges. Fearing the return of Habsburg domination in the lands of the Swiss cantons, at the end of 1314, the communities supported Louis IV of Bavaria. He was then vying for the imperial throne, along with Frederick I of Habsburg. The conflict between the Habsburgs and the cantons escalated after a raid by the men of Schwitz, led by Werner Stauffacher, against the Einsiedeln Abbey. This attack provoked an official response from Duke Leopold I of Habsburg. He gathered a well-armed army, knights and infantry. According to various sources, his force numbered between 2,000 and 9,000 men. The Duke aimed to crush the people of Schwitz without engaging in open battle. He planned to defeat them by cunning. Leopold divided his army into several small detachments for maneuvering. One was sent toward Arth to attack from the northwest. Another was to strike Unterwalden from the north, advancing from Entlebuch. A third detachment moved from Lucerne to attack Schwitz from the west, across Lake Lucerne. The last, under the command of Count Otto von Strasburg, was to cross the Brunig Pass to Obwalden. The Duke believed these maneuvers would confuse the men of Schwitz and force them to divide their forces. But Leopold's ruse failed. The Confederates were warned of the danger by their neighbors. According to legend, they received messages written on parchment attached to arrows that fell right beside the Schwitz camp. On them was written, "Beware at Morgarten." Forewarned, the men of Schwitz were ready for the attack. On November 15, 1315, the forces of Leopold I of Habsburg advanced along the narrow road by Lake Eggeri toward the Morgarten Pass. Because of the difficult terrain, the column stretched for several kilometers. The narrow path ran between a steep slope and a marshy lakeshore, so the heavily armed cavalry could not maneuver or fight in coordination. This vulnerability proved fatal for the army of Leopold I of Habsburg. The warriors from the cantons of Schwitz, Uri, and Unterwalden knew this terrain perfectly. They had taken up positions in advance on the heights above the path and set up an ambush at the narrowest point of the route. As soon as the vanguard of the Habsburg army entered the gorge, heavy boulders, wooden logs, and rocks came crashing down on their heads from the slopes. This caused chaos. Frightened horses threw off their riders, the chains of troops broke apart, and the heavy cavalry could neither turn around nor put up organized resistance. At that moment, the Swiss infantry attacked from the flanks. Armed with halberds, clubs and flails, the warriors moved swiftly along the slopes they had been accustomed to since childhood. Agile and enduring, they easily struck down their disoriented enemies. In the narrow pass, the heavily armored knights lost their greatest advantage, mobility. Their armor became a burden, and the terrain a trap for the entire cavalry. Some Austrians didn't even have time to draw their swords. They were cut down before the battle even began. The rest fled in panic. Cavalry trampled their own infantry in retreat. Many men and horses perished in the swamps or drowned in the lake. The campaign turned into a devastating rout. Duke Leopold himself narrowly escaped, fleeing the battlefield. This was an unexpected yet brilliant triumph for the Swiss. They proved that disciplined infantry, with tactical advantage and knowledge of the terrain, could defeat the Empire's elite cavalry. After the Battle of Morgarten, the Swiss Confederacy did not gain the peace they hoped for with the Habsburgs. Nonetheless, the shared victory strengthened the unity of the three cantons. They renewed their alliance by concluding the Pact of Brunnen, an agreement guaranteeing mutual defense and brotherly support. In March 1316, Emperor Louis IV officially confirmed the rights of the Forest Cantons. After their triumph at Morgarten, the Confederates continued the struggle. At that time, Lucerne was an important trade and transit center located on the shore of Lake of the Four Cantons, a key waterway that opened the route to the Alpine passes from the north. Although the city remained under Habsburg rule, more and more burghers grew dissatisfied with the restrictions on their rights, the excessive interference of imperial governors, and the burden of taxation. Awareness was growing in the city. The surrounding free communities had already united in an alliance based on mutual defense and self-government. In 1332, the Council of Lucerne, realizing that imperial power provided no security and only hindered development, turned to the cantons with a request to join. This was not just a political decision, but an act of civic courage, a desire to free themselves from external domination and secure for their city a free and safe future. The next to join the Confederacy was Zurich. This city was the largest and most influential in the region. But within its walls, fierce internal struggle was raging. The interests of the old aristocracy clashed with those of the guild-based urban community. In 1336, Rudolf Brunn led an uprising of artisans and merchants, overthrew the aristocratic council, and introduced a new guild constitution. By this, he made enemies both in the city and beyond. The nobility, having lost power, conspired with Rapperswil and other feudal lords. They were preparing a counterattack. In these circumstances, aware of its isolation and danger, Zurich began to seek new allies. In 1351, the city joined the old cantons, concluding with them an eternal alliance. Zurich strengthened the Confederacy with its economic potential and cultural influence, while in return it received military support and security guarantees. After Zurich's accession to the Confederacy, pressure on Zug increased sharply. From the west came the new alliance, from the east the Habsburg vassals who sought to retain power. Tensions grew in the city. Peasants, artisans, and small traders feared that the conflict between imperial power and the Confederates would drag Zug into war. To prevent its streets from becoming a battlefield, the city council made a fateful decision: to conclude an eternal alliance with the Swiss cantons. This was a cautious step, for formally, Zug remained a Habsburg vassal, but in fact it sided with the Confederacy. A similar situation arose in Glarus. That same year, its community signed a pact with the Confederates. Even so, formally, the city remained under Habsburg control. The last city to join the alliance at that time was Bern. It had maintained an alliance with the Forest Canton since the first quarter of the century. Nevertheless, that was only a military agreement. The city became a full member of the Swiss Confederacy only in 1353. A key event that brought them closer was the Battle of Laupen on June 21, 1339. The army of Bern and its allies, about 6,000 men, repelled the siege of the Counts of Burgundy, the Habsburgs, and the city of Freiburg, about 12,000 to 16,000 men. The Bernese took up positions on the heights near the village of Laupen. They formed battle lines of pikes and halberds and repelled all attacks. Then the Swiss launched a counteroffensive and crushed the enemy. This victory demonstrated the strength and effectiveness of Swiss infantry against feudal cavalry. It became a symbol of Bern's independence and confirmed its place in the Confederacy. Thus, in 1353, the classical League of Eight Cantons was formed. Uri, Schwitz, Unterwalden, Lucerne, Zurich, Zug, Glarus, and Bern. Formally, each of them concluded a separate, eternal alliance, since there was no single centralized authority. But in practice, a confederation emerged, with shared military obligations, diplomatic agreements, and mutual support. This union gradually became a real political alternative to Habsburg rule in the Alpine region. The expansion of the Confederacy and the strengthening of its autonomy increasingly irritated the Habsburgs. They were losing influence in a region where they considered themselves unquestioned rulers. In 1385, the forces of Zurich, Zug, and Lucerne carried out a series of raids on Austrian fortresses, without declaring war and without a coordinated plan. Duke Leopold III of Habsburg attempted to curb the Confederacy's growth by force. He set his sights on the city of Lucerne. It was an ally of Bern and a strategic link between the Alps and the northern lands. Leopold gathered an army of several thousand well-armed soldiers, including many Austrian knights. On July 9, 1386, near the town of Sempach, the Austrians clashed with the army of the Swiss cantons. The Confederates acted in coordination. Despite the numerical superiority of the enemy, the Swiss chose the tactics of close combat and once again used the terrain to their advantage, just as they had earlier at Morgarten. It is known that during the battle, the Swiss found themselves in difficulty, as the Austrian cavalry had the advantage. Still, according to legend, the turning point came when one of the Swiss warriors, Arnold von Winkelried, threw himself onto the enemy pikes and with his own body broke through the Habsburg formation of spearmen. In doing so, he opened a passage for his comrades. The Swiss rushed through the gap and engaged in close combat. Panic spread through the Austrian ranks. The battle ended in a crushing defeat for Leopold III. The Duke was killed in the fight, along with many members of the Austrian nobility. The Swiss losses were much smaller. The defeat seriously undermined the power of the Austrian Habsburgs in the region. After the victory at Sempach, the Swiss Confederates did not stop. Their military triumph over Duke Leopold III of Austria gave them new confidence. The representatives of the Swiss Confederacy sought to expand their influence and firmly secure control over the border regions. The Austrians decided to respond with determination. In 1388, an Austrian army advanced toward Glarus, aiming to isolate it and destroy the Confederates. They were supported by another column, which was to close the circle from the south. The plan was simple: attack simultaneously from two sides before the main forces of the Confederacy could react. Against them stood a small militia from Glarus, reinforced by troops from Schwitz and Unterwalden. At first, the advantage was on the side of the Austrians. The Swiss retreated to the nearest hills, the heights of Rockberg. Seeing their opponent abandon positions, many Austrian soldiers rushed to plunder and destroy the surrounding villages and farms. The army ranks fell apart. The soldiers scattered. In the evening, it began to snow, and soon a thick fog set in. Taking advantage of the bad weather, the Swiss unexpectedly attacked the enemy's main force. The battle lasted several hours and ended with the complete rout of the Austrian army. The remnants of the force tried to retreat to Wiesen, but the bridge across the Linth had been destroyed. Many Austrians drowned in the river during the crossing. Despite the victory, both sides, the Confederates and the Austrians, desired peace. At first, it was concluded for 7 years, and in 1394, extended for another 2 decades. The Habsburgs officially renounced all rights to the 8 cantons, and with them, access to the Alpine passes. These peace terms emphasized the strength of the Confederation. The Alpine passes had key importance, not only strategic, but also economic. Through them, the Habsburgs could transfer their troops to northern Italy, thereby strengthening their influence in the region. At the same time, these were vital trade routes that brought profits to whoever controlled them. The Swiss victories of the 14th century were no accident. Their strength lay in a well-organized infantry, which acted as a coordinated combat mechanism. The core of the army consisted of pikemen, foot soldiers armed with long spears or pikes, who fought in tight phalanxes. Such units could stop even heavy cavalry, which until then was considered invincible. Alongside the pikemen fought halberdiers, close combat warriors. They attacked after breaking through enemy ranks. Their axe-like halberds were especially effective against horsemen and heavily armed infantry. Crossbowmen were also important and indispensable in the Swiss army. They were placed on flanks or high ground, from where they covered the infantry. Crossbows reloaded slowly, but they struck hard and hit the enemy even before the melee began. Swiss tactics were based on rapid marches, sudden attacks, and coordinated formations. They skillfully used the mountainous terrain, striking the enemy in narrow gorges and mountain passes, where the opponent's numerical advantage lost its force. Each unit was well-trained, disciplined, and cohesive. Even in the hardest moments, the Swiss held formation and did not give in to panic. This method of warfare became a real revolution. Already by the end of the 14th century, Swiss infantry had gained fame across Europe. It proved that well-organized foot soldiers could not only withstand knights, but also defeat them. It was the Swiss who paved the way to the century of infantry in European warfare. It is no surprise that rulers of many European countries sought to have Swiss infantry in their armies. It was distinguished by iron discipline, combat experience, and high effectiveness on the battlefield. The Swiss fought in tight formation. The phalanx, armed with long pikes, halberds, and crossbows, and later with firearms as well. Their advance was unstoppable, and their defense nearly impenetrable. The Swiss served in France, the Holy Roman Empire, and the Kingdom of Naples. They fought against the Burgundians, took part in Italian campaigns, and in conflicts between European dynasties. Their units often decided the outcome of battles, for example, in the Lombard Wars. The Swiss Guards of the French King and the Papal Swiss Guard, created in 1506, became especially famous. The first contingent of the Guard consisted of 150 soldiers under the command of Caspar von Zielenen. The Swiss Guard became a symbol of loyalty and the martial spirit of the Confederation. Though within Switzerland, attitudes toward mercenary service were mixed, some cantons tried to control it. Eventually, a system of capitulations arose. Agreements that defined the conditions of service under foreign rulers and limited the scale of mercenary activities. Despite the ambivalence, Swiss mercenaries became a symbol of the era, the model of the best infantry of the late Middle Ages and early modern times. Swiss glory reached its peak during the Burgundian Wars. Then, the Confederates faced Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy. His plans to advance eastward threatened the interests of Switzerland and the Holy Roman Empire. The Swiss acted together with Alsace, Lorraine, and imperial forces against a common enemy. The decisive battles once again confirmed the effectiveness of Swiss infantry. At the Battle of Héricourt, the Burgundians were defeated. At Grandson in 1476, the Swiss crushed the much larger army of the Duke. That same year at Merton, they virtually annihilated his forces. The war concluded with the Battle of Nancy in January 1477. Charles the Bold was killed, and Burgundy lost its independence. Victories in the Burgundian Wars solidified the reputation of the Swiss as one of the strongest military forces in Europe. their infantry, organized in dense phalanxes with halberds and pikes, finally dispelled the stereotype of heavy cavalry's invincibility. Thus, it is entirely understandable that after these campaigns, the demand for Swiss mercenaries on the continent rose sharply. Other states also adopted their military experience. The series of victories over the Austrian Habsburgs, and later over the armies of Charles the Bold, established the Confederation as a significant military power. Yet, by the early 16th century, it became clear. Endless wars drained not only resources, but also undermined the unity of the cantons. The turning point was the Battle of Marignano in 1515, when the combined Swiss forces suffered a crushing defeat from the French army. This blow forced the Confederation to reconsider its role in European wars. Already in 1516, they concluded the perpetual peace with France. It became, in effect, the first step toward abandoning aggressive foreign policy. In the 16th century, the cantons increasingly declared neutrality in major conflicts, although Swiss mercenaries continued to serve in foreign armies, and this remained common. At the same time, within the country, a distinctive policy gradually formed: rejection of territorial expansion, focus on internal order, defense of borders, and development of republican autonomy. This period became a time of profound change in Swiss identity. The Reformation, which spread to some cantons and to important allied cities, led to sharp religious conflicts between Protestants and Catholics. At times, they escalated into armed clashes. At the same time, these events helped the Confederation to recognize its internal diversity. It was then that the idea of Switzerland began to form. Not as a homogeneous nation, but as a union of equal communities, different in language, faith, and culture, yet united by a shared history of struggle for freedom. Thus, in the 16th century, neutrality became not only foreign policy, but also a way to preserve internal peace. It was on this foundation that a new Swiss identity emerged. Victories over the Habsburgs and Burgundy, successful resistance to the expansion of great monarchies, all this established the Swiss Confederation as a political reality that could not be ignored. And its military glory became a powerful force. Swiss mercenaries became the standard of infantry across Europe, from the fields of France to the palaces of the Pope. But Switzerland's true victory was not the conquest of foreign lands, but the preservation of its own. It was precise military skill, cohesion, and readiness for defense that allowed the Confederation not only to survive in the turbulent heart of Europe, but also to establish neutrality as the foundation of its future.